Today on Rocking the Suburbs, we talk about the seventh son of a seventh son.
Seriously? That paternity suit was thrown out.
Well, welcome to Rocking the Suburbs. Jim and Patrick are away. Mike Coley and I are here standing in, and we have made it to the midpoint of Iron Maiden week. We hope you've enjoyed it so far, and we hope you're going to enjoy the rest of what we talk about today. So, hi again, Mike. It's good to be back and continuing our deep dive into the large and varied catalogue of Iron Maiden.
Let's move forward.
Let's get straight to the action then. We finished up in 1986 with Somewhere in Time yesterday, and again, due to massive world tours, we move on to 1988 for the next album arrives, and that's The Seventh Son of a Seventh Son. And for my money, this is the other one with Power Slave. That's the 1A / 1B as their best work. I just sort of flip flop. It might have slightly edged ahead having listened to it again recently. It just reminded me just how good it is. But this continues the high quality run we've been on ever since Number of the Beast. And so what's your thoughts on Seventh Son of a Seventh Son, Mike?
So after Somewhere in Time, I was kind of fading away a little bit. This album came out and I wasn't immediately sold on it for whatever reason. I'm not even sure what the reason would be. I mean, it came out in '88. I know they had a tour scheduled, and they were supposed to play right in my area, like 10 miles away from me at one of the auditoriums here. And I was going to this one. I was going to finally see Iron Maiden. I wanted to see Iron Maiden. And for whatever reason, that show got canceled. And I was supremely bummed.
I bet. Yes, I can imagine.
And so I didn't get to see them. And maybe that had an effect on me listening to this album. I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. But as I came back to it, though, there's some classic Maiden songs on this one, too. I mean, there we go using the word classic again. But, I mean, how can you not when you have such great writing, songwriting? I mean, they have these fantastic writers within the band who all can mm-hmm. contribute. So it's not all Steve Harris stuff. It's not all Bruce Dickinson stuff. It's not all, you know, Adrian Smith hadn't done a whole lot of contributions. But Somewhere in Time was, you know, like you said in the previous episode, that was his album, yeah. Mainly because of the number of songs that were used that he had written. But, this is a concept album. It's got lengthy songs. This is where Maiden is continuing their lengthy epics. Mm-hmm. And this is just another classic Maiden album. It's one that I'm still, you know, it's still not in the upper echelon for me, but that doesn't mean it's a bad album. It's just the way I got into it, I guess.
Yeah, and I think it probably it's telling actually, Mike, that for our slightly different approaches to metal, that you like sort of punky stuff as well, whereas I'm much more into the proggy stuff, and I've talked on the podcast before, about Dream Theater and how much a band massively, massively influenced by Iron Maiden, amongst many others. And indeed, a band who covered Number of the Beast in its entirety at some of their shows.
Dream Theater did?
Yeah, oh. I've got that. And it's an official bootleg release that you can get from the website. I've got that, yeah, them covering. They did Master of Puppets. They did... Number of the Beasts, and they did what's the Rush one, the famous one,
2112.
That's the one. Yeah, I think they did that as well. Yeah, all bands who had a huge influence on Dream Theater. But this is more proggy. This is definitely we're edging away from Run to the Hills. Although there are two songs in particular on here which stand comparison with any of their other songs. As like basically, if you want to call it hit singles, but it's definitely it's that concept album. It's very it's heading in a slightly different direction, And even though we maybe didn't realise it at the time, it also was going to mark the change that's been happening. It was going to get accelerated much more after this. But talking of hit singles, like this was probably the album where I really started to, rather than being aware of Iron Maiden, I started to listen to Iron Maiden.
Mm-hmm.
So I was 17 in sixth form when this came out, and Can I Play With Madness was the first single. And I remember listening to the Top 40 Countdown on Sunday night, which is something he used to do when he was a teenager on Radio 1. And Can I Play With Madness went in at number 2 on the UK singles chart.
It's amazing, but I'm guessing that didn't happen. It did get a lot of airplay here. It really did.
Uh-huh.
But not Top 40. Definitely, you know, the rock stations were playing it. And it does have more of a rock and roll, more so than a metal feel to it.
Yeah, yes. And I think Bruce's lyric writing is very much driven by, he had an overall concept for the lyrics on this album, and it runs with that. But yeah, it was, I remember it's like, what? This song is coming straight in at number 2. This is like, it just is like, what? Now, of course, I soon realised that a lot of bands with a cult following would have singles that would chart very high and then plummet without trace after the following week. It'd be number 2 week 1, and it'd be like number 35 the second week,
right,
and then it'd be gone because all the fans bought it in the first week and then no one else bought it. But nonetheless, it's still a number 2 UK hit single, which, again, something many bands haven't achieved. But anyway, so let's take a quick listen to Can I Play With Madness, and then we'll talk a little bit more.
Can I play with madness?
Starts off with a bang, but a different kind of bang, doesn't it? Just with those like multi-track vocals of Bruce, just like wham, and then in we go.
Now, so speaking of that, I think that's what threw me off with this song. Was I wish they hadn't opened with that little vocal intro. Mm-hmm. It just, I don't know, maybe a little cheesiness factor to it, in my opinion anyway. But if they had jumped right into it with the riffs and then, mm-hmm. you know, just continued that chorus later on in the song, I think I would have gravitated a little bit more to it, if that makes sense.
I totally get what you're saying, Mike. I think I get what you're saying, because it's highly polished, and it's certainly more commercial sounding mm-hmm. than some of the earlier stuff. And it's still got the trademark gallop, and it's, you know, it's got all the things you expect from Iron Maiden. But it, yeah, you still got the keyboards fairly prominent there as well, which just gives it that's again a bit. It's not. This is definitely better sounding than Somewhere in Time. It doesn't suffer. The production stands up much better than Somewhere in Time's production, I think.
Yeah, it doesn't have that 80s-ness sound to it.
Yeah. The synths are there, but it's just not. It's just everything's just toned down a notch. The guitars are a little bit more guitar-y and less sort of mushy. But also I'm presuming you're aware of the Monty Python connection to this song.
I didn't catch the Monty Python reference.
Now, I've just remembered that I need to make sure I'm getting my facts exactly right, but the video for Can I Play With Madness Yeah, it features Graham Chapman in which will be one of his last performances on TV before his death in 1989. So, there you go.
Well, how about that?
Yeah, so Graham Chapman is in the video for Can I Play With Madness? So, if any Monty Python fans out there, which I'm guessing there's maybe a few. I'm going to have to play another song from this album, Mike, I'm afraid. Sorry. Because the second single and the song which follows is directly on the album. I talk about that. They do like their 1-2 punches sometimes. Uh-huh. With absolute bangers. Because The Evil That Men Do, this is probably my favourite Iron Maiden song. This is probably number one for me.
No kidding. This is definitely my favourite song from this album, for sure.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's the best song on the album, I think, by far. But it's probably my favourite. It's probably my favourite from theirs. Yeah, if you're talking the top five, you've got, obviously, Hallowed Be Thy Name is in there. Trooper's in there. This is probably number one for me.
And so, this got some airplay on the rock stations here, too.
Okay. Good stuff. Excellent. No, that's good to hear. This didn't chart anything like as well as Can I Play With Madness, but... because the album was out by then. But anyway, let's take a quick blast of The Evil That Men Do, and then we shall continue. Sing.
Yeah, he can.
Man, he can sing.
And again, with the literature/historical references, The Evil That Men Do from Shakespeare's Julius Caesar. And
yeah, it's just
Dickinson, you know, he introduced, you know, some of the live shows, he introduced the song in that way. This line, The Evil That Men Do, is part of that Shakespeare work.
And it's kind of it's one of those phrases that, again, resonates down the ages, doesn't it?
It's ever present.
There's truth in it. I think going back to your slight coolness on this album, also got maybe particularly with those two songs as well, Mike, is unusually for Iron Maiden, they are songs which follow the standard rock format in that you have a verse, you've got a pre-chorus, you've got a chorus. A lot of the other songs we've talked about don't have that. Like Hallowed Be Thy Name is a song which just keeps... It goes through different phases, but it doesn't... There's not a chorus, not a verse.
It's just a story being told.
There's just different sections. There's just sections of the song. Yeah, Phantom of the Opera, there's different sections of the song. Those two songs, and particularly You Don't Mean Do, is very much a defined... This is a rock song. You can break it down much more ordinarily than you can with a lot of their other stuff. I realised that I should have mentioned this after Can I Play With Madness, because it really struck me. I was half expecting the Collier drums to come out again on some of those Tom Fields from Nico.
Sorry, I was reaching for my Trooper beer.
there were some killer Tom Fields on Can I Play With Madness. But, so Seventh Son might also say marks an ending, because it marks the end of the run of the classic lineup. because after this, after the tour which followed this album, it wasn't long before Adrian Smith left the band, and being sort of somewhat dissatisfied, I think he felt they were overplaying the songs too much and too fast and all this sort of stuff. And you can see some of that in the documentaries that's out there, and the Made in England concert footage as well. In that, he was feeling dissatisfied, so he left the band and wouldn't appear on the next album to come from this. And having expressed my love for his sort of musical talents and what he brings to the band, even if it's only in a subtle way sometimes, I think that really tells me when we move on to No Prayer for the Dying, which comes out 2 years later in 1990. I've got a lot of thoughts about this next one. And most of them aren't that good, to be honest with you. But so what do you think about No Prayer for the Dying?
No Prayer for the Dying is one that I really did not even venture into. As soon as Adrian Smith left the band, similar to your thoughts, he was a big part of the band for me. And I just, I fell off. And there was a period of time where I was getting into other things. You know, that's when grunge was starting to take off. And so I ventured away from the classic metal sounds and went back more to my punk roots and started listening to, you know, a lot of the grunge stuff. And so it didn't really fit my worldview at that point. So, and then not too long after this, Bruce released his Tattooed Millionaire album. And yes, that one, I really didn't, I purchased it, but that didn't grab me at all either.
No, well, it's a different kettle of fish entirely. And I think largely, yeah, it's a double whammy on this album, because you've got, I think actually Tattooed Millionaire was recorded before No Prayer for the Dying, possibly, because the reason that Yannick Gers, who comes in on guitar to replace Adrian Smith, is that he'd played with Bruce on Tattooed Millionaire.
Yeah.
I think that's right. So, and again, he's an excellent guitar player, but he's very different from both Dave Murray and from Adrian Smith. He's a very frenetic, and more kind of straight ahead rock kind of style, I would say. I mean, he's an amazing guitar player. Don't get me wrong, I'm not putting him down in any way, shape, or form. He's an excellent musician. But he doesn't bring to the band what Adrian Smith brought to the band, with that slightly askance kind of approach to maybe playing things. It's much more straight ahead rocking. And yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned Tattooed Millionaire, because there's a couple of songs on this album that should be nowhere near an Iron Maiden album. They are clearly, feel to me, like songs that should have been on Tattooed Millionaire. Songs like, I mean, Holy Smoke, I mean, it's undeniably entertaining and funny, but it's not really an Iron Maiden song.
No, it's kind of a campy song.
And then you've got Hooks in You and Bring Your Daughter. Neither of them really are Iron Maiden songs either.
Bring Your Daughter, just they really bummed me out that they actually recorded that song. It went number one in some places, and it did get...
It went number one here. There was a number one thing. I know there's supposed to be a sense of humour to it, but just the title alone is kind of like a bit distasteful, really.
Yeah, exactly.
It feels like a bit of a blemish on their career, to my mind, because it's, it's not really, it doesn't sound like Iron Maiden. It's just honestly like generic 90s rock or 80s rock, really.
Yeah.
And Hooks in You is like, what is this doing on an Iron Maiden album? This is not Iron Maiden. This is just, you know. You compare Bring Your Daughter to the song that closes the album, Mother Russia. It's like, oh, okay, this is what Iron Maiden sounds like. Mother Russia, that's fantastic.
This is Iron Maiden. Yeah.
More of this, less of that. So, things were declining, and there is going to be a brief final hurrah, but I think we'll skip from playing anything from No Prayer for the Dying, if that's okay with you, Mike. We'll gloss over that quite happily.
I'm cool with that.
And we'll move on to 1992 and Fear of the Dark. And this would mark Bruce Dickinson's final album with the band, for now anyway. He would leave the band after recording this album, feeling that he felt that things had run their course. And again, this is a patchy album. You got From Here to Eternity, which it sounds like Motley Crue. I mean, there's a place for Motley Crue, a very small place for Motley Crue, but you know, but the place for Motley Crue is not on an Iron Maiden album. The one redeeming feature for Fear of the Dark is the closing and title track, which again, it's a top five song in their catalog.
Yeah, that's an absolute classic, and it became a staple of their live show too, which is absolutely beautiful witnessing live.
It's phenomenal live,
especially when you watch those like those shows in South America where they just bring hundreds of thousands of people to these monster stadiums, and the whole crowd is singing along with them. It's an epic song.
Well, let's take a quick listen to some of that. Unfortunately, we can't listen to all of it, much as we would like to. But again, like Hallowed Be Thy Name, this is one you want to seek out because it's another 7 minute plus classic. But boy, is it good. Of the dark. It's hard to pick the right bit to play that because it's like it's all so good, but you got to get the bit where it rocks hard.
You have to. It brings back that Maiden sound that was somewhat lacking in the previous couple releases. It's got that slow build up and then jumps into high gear, and it's a classic Maiden song.
Yeah, seeing it live.
Fits right in.
Yeah, I mean it's. Yeah, when they tour, if they've got a new album, they tend to alternate their tours, don't they? They'll do a tour supporting a new album, and then when that's wrapped up, that tour cycle, they'll do another tour doing like a greatest hits tour, and you know, they don't do a greatest hits tour without playing this because it's one of the with sort of Run to the Hills and Hallowed Be Thy Name, it's probably one of the three highlights of the live show because it's just and as you alluded to, Mike. Look up on YouTube for some of the many live versions, particularly in some of these big football stadiums around the world where you got 100,000 plus people just all singing along with Bruce. Just, I mean, it gives you goosebumps, it's phenomenal.
I'm kind of past that stage in life where I want to go to these huge monster shows, but I still, my bucket list is still going to Rio to see Iron Maiden in a monster stadium with 200,000 people. Just to feel that energy and that vibe.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, it's quite something. And we'll maybe come back to their worldwide appeal as we get into the more into the back end of their career. But what strikes me though, Mike, really is that Bruce left the band after this thing. He felt the things had run their course. But this was the last song, and what he's at the time was his last performance for the band. and you're like, what a way to go out.
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
Talk about, don't not get, go out with a bang, not a whimper. My goodness.
Like George Costanza said, go out on a high note.
I mean, yeah, this is, you know, this is, you know, walking out undefeated, you know, like, okay, we might have got a bit patchy in the last few years, but man, this is, we're leaving you with one of the best things we've ever done, you know? Mm-hmm. And yes, so that's a real highlight. And again, yeah, please listen to the whole song because you won't regret it. It's an absolute all-time great song from the band. Well, we'll briefly touch on the next two albums and then we'll today, Mike, if that's all right, and then we'll move into the next stage of their career tomorrow. We talked about Bruce having he left the band, so again the personnel changes have continued, and he was replaced with a guy called Blaze Bailey. And he took over vocal duties for the next two albums, 1995's X Factor and 1998's Virtual 11. And, yeah, I don't know what your thoughts are on the Blaze Bailey era, Mike.
The Klansman sticks out, definitely, is one that is, you know, it could have been a Bruce song. Mm-hmm. Vocal song. Blaze's vocals are definitely not, you know, you're not going to get Bruce, obviously. Mm-hmm. But his vocals, for me, they just didn't hit. They didn't hit at all for me. When I had heard that he had joined the band, he was in Wolfsbane, I believe, before that.
That's correct, yeah.
And I did purchase the Wolfsbane album that was available to me here just to give it a listen to see where he came from. That was, you know, right around the time that this all happened. And that's a good rock and roll album. I really dig where he fits in with Wolfsbane, but to me, he just didn't fit in with the Maiden sound at all.
No, I think, I mean, he was on a hide into nothing, really, because you're replacing one of the greatest, most iconic vocalists in rock and metal music of all time. So that's, yeah.
Right, he's in a situation there.
Yeah, Ronnie James Dio can get away with replacing Ozzy because he's also, Ronnie James Dio is one of the greatest vocalists in the history of rock music as well.
Yes.
But unless you are Ronnie James Dio level, it's gonna go badly for you. But I think the band knew it as well. I mean, they were swimming upstream at this time. You know, you'd had grunge, your Britpop was exploding, you know, metal was pretty much dead commercially. You know, unless your name was Metallica, no one was buying your records. But I think they knew, it was almost like they felt they had to keep going because they didn't want to break up the band. Yeah, they just wanted to keep going because Steve Harris was like, no, this is my band and no one's going to tell me when my band's finished. It's my band. And
exactly. Yeah, it's Steve Harris.
But then you listen to the mix, you listen to X Factor and the first track opens up and like, okay, it starts with a bit instrumental. Well, that's nothing unusual with an Iron Maiden record. But then his vocals are mixed so low in the mix. Yeah, the second album that he was on Virtual 11, the vocals are mixed kind of higher and more prominently. But on that first album, the vocals are buried low in the mix. It's almost like we don't really want to overexpose this guy. We don't want to, you know, maybe people won't notice that it's not Bruce. I mean, it's like as if you wouldn't.
Yeah. Let's just make it a little bit quieter.
Yeah. And yeah, you're right. The Klansman's is a really good song. I'd also highlight Sign of the Cross and Man on the Edge as good songs, which. The only thing about them is that the live versions with Bruce doing them are like 20 times better.
Yep.
Yeah. The band sound flat as well. Yeah, you can tell it just really feels like their heart's on it. Now, I know Steve Harris was going through a divorce during X Factor, and that probably had an impact. He said explicitly stated it had an impact on the album, but it's just, yeah, there's no life, there's no spark. It's just like, man, what is this really? Is this even Iron Maiden?
Right. It's just trying to keep things moving along and try to get to the next step.
You could still produce classics without Adrian. They produce classics without Bruce. You know, sort of pre-Bruce, but without both of them, no, it couldn't be done.
That's a tough order.
It was. Now, we'll wrap up for today shortly, unless you've got any other thoughts on that, Mike. My final thought I would add, though, would be that probably the best performance of the Blaze Bailey era is not on either of these albums. It's actually a B-side. I don't know if you've heard their version of My Generation, which was a B-side.
I have not.
well, it doesn't sound like Iron Maiden, but it sounds like an absolutely ripping version of My Generation.
Now you got to check that one out.
I'll maybe put that on as the play out. It sounds like a band full of energy because they're playing the songs that they grew up listening to, mm-hmm. as opposed to the two albums which just sound flat and uninspired. So anyway, we'll add that in for the play out. And I need to say, Jim and Patrick will be back soon. They're taking a well-deserved break while Mike and I rabbit on about Iron Maiden. If you want to contact the show, it's at SuburbsPod on the socials. You can email the show, rock@suburbspod.com. You can call the Suburban Party Line on
612-440-1984.
You can contact me on, I'm on Twitter at powderfinger71, or just plain old Stephen Routledge on Facebook. And Mike, you are?
I am at Mike Coley on Twitter. I am also a Mike Coley in real life and on Facebook. And if you want to check out my website, 315music.com, I cover a whole bunch of what's happening in the central New York music scene and anything that comes through this area.
Excellent. Okay. Well, cheers, Mike. It's been great again. And we'll talk again tomorrow.
Cheers, Stephen.
Don't you just fade away? Talking about my generation. Don't try and dig what we all see. Talking about my generation. I'm not trying to cause a big sensation. Talking about my generation. Talking about my generation. Talking about my generation. My generation. My generation, baby. My generation, baby.
Get this wrong and maybe fix it in post.